Accession number 23228, Mill 11.
Professor Hugh de Wardener, Mill 11.
Yes, we were in the Suez Canal. I don't remember much about it, except there was very little to see. That was what impressed me. You saw a few camels, and of course the water level is below, and the embankments of the canal are quite high, so you really don't see much except if you're lucky enough that there's a camel on the embankment. You can't see much further out. But we didn't stop on the way through. On either side, we kept going. And my next recollection is through going through the Mediterranean, and we were moored outside Gibraltar in a thunderstorm at night. And I do remember looking out, and suddenly a flash of lightning, and there was the rock, and then out. It was a wonderful sight. So it sort of blew away all the other. It was a bit boring coming home. It took a very long time, it seemed. And we got letters. Our first proper letters that we got were at Gibraltar that met us. That must have been a bit of organization to know who was on board our ship and get the letters there, but they did it. And I had some not very good news, which I needn't go into.
I was wondering about, you know, communications in the war. Had your family been advised that you were a prisoner?
Yes.
They knew where
They knew straight away. A fall of Singapore, I was there, I mean. And they didn't, there was no message that I'd been killed or anything. And they didn't get a card. We sent, I think, two cards, maybe three, the whole time we were there. And I think they got one about 18 months after I was in. There was one fellow who wrote to his wife, "We're having a lovely time. Would you please tell it to the Marines?" Just to get by the censor. This was. I think somebody said they addressed it to Churchill, but I doubt whether the Mr. Churchill, 10 Downing Street, might have got through. You never know. Yes, they didn't know straight away, of course. But of course, they didn't know whether we were still alive. They knew we were there. But it took some while, I think, before the Red Cross were involved. I don't know. My mother was in America, and my wife was in England.
Did you ever get letters or news from them?
No. Did we? Yes, we did. I think we got one letter, because I do remember knowing that Simon had been born, and I don't see how I knew that unless I got a letter. But it could only have been one letter in the whole time. That's quite right. I'd forgotten it. Like the Red Cross parcels. The Nips took all the Red Cross parcels. And on the day the railway opened, big munificence, they let each prisoner have 1/12 of one parcel. Well, they took them usually. Yes, that was the day that I think my allotment was a tin of pilchards, which was very good indeed, I must admit. And other people had tin milk. I never realized how good carnation milk could be. You make two holes in the tin and suck it. Wonderful if you haven't anything sweet. Very, very good. Yes, it's interesting. I'd forgotten about that letter. Yes, there must have been a letter. But you can hardly talk about correspondence. I mean,
did it have an effect on morale, do you think? The fact that you didn't get...
Well, it must have done. It must have done. But
how about your own situation?
I don't imagine we expected it. I certainly didn't expect it. I mean, if you're only allowed to send a card every 2 years, you don't really think that they're going to bother about giving you letters, are they? No.
And also, you know, being away from home and being cut off for so long, I was wondering about your feelings as you were approaching home. Was it, was it just joy at being back, or was it more complicated?
Well, you're curious, a bit nervous how it all would work out, obviously. Yes, yes. I don't know what other people's worries were. My main worry was my career. I mean, I had no family. I mean, I had my wife, but I had no family in England. I had no background in England. I didn't really know England very well. I mean, I'd been a medical student. I'd been at public school and a medical student. But even in the holidays, I went back to France. So, I mean, I didn't really get to know the English or something until I got in the army. I mean, no, all right. As a medical student, you learn a lot. But I had no background in England. I was very worried about what was going to happen to me. And I wanted to become a consultant. And this meant having to take my membership of the Royal College of Physicians. And that meant I wouldn't be able to work for a year. Obviously, while I was taking it, well, it would be much easier to take it like that. So I think these were uppermost in my mind, really, what was going to happen. I've always had a fear of poverty, always. Poverty is a prisoner, is a terrible thing, terrible. It's a prison. It's a worse prison than being a prisoner of war, in a way. And I've always been afraid of poverty. And I've never been able to instill it in my children, unfortunately. They don't seem to have any worries about that. And it's worked out all right for three of them, but one of them still doesn't worry enough. So that perhaps this obsessional view about poverty made me think about my career. And anyhow, we got home and started life again. It was a bit stilted at first, and it was interesting. One had to hold one's peace when one was being told on how dreadful the diet had been in the country. But it's, as you say, everything's relative. And one of the things I remember vividly was going to the cinema and being terribly moved by things that happened on the cinema, because the cinema had moved on, and people hitting each other and people doing this, that, and the other, and I and the sadness. I was crying in the cinema. I mean, I cry now occasionally, but it takes a lot now. It's pretty rare, but there. My threshold was not high enough for what was now going on in the cinema. Interesting. And I think that's gone on and on and on, so now you see the most appalling things, which if I were prisoner of war coming out now, I'd probably tears all the time, I should think. I went back to Thomas's and was lucky enough to get onto a course that they were running. They were running a course for 10 people from the services who wanted to take their membership for 1 year. And I got onto that course. And that was marvelous. And at the end of the year, I took my membership and I just got it.
So you were then a consultant?
Well, you can't become a consultant without it, and you're not a consultant with it, but you can't be a consultant without it. That's the point.
So you were eligible.
That's right, yes. You then have to acquire experience. And
how was your health? during this time?
Fine. I had one or two things. Well, no, I'm overdoing it. I had what's called, it used to be called, I don't know what the new name for it, post-dysenteric, oh Lord, well, call it colic. It's people who had dysentery, and I can only explain what I had, and I imagine that's what other people are complaining of, because that's what sounds like it, is intense colic in the colon, but a descending colon. So there's a bit of diarrhea with it, but it's usually, you have this appalling colic. I mean, I don't know what having a baby's like. I should hate it, but it's agony. I remember hanging onto the curtain once and almost bringing it down. It's so painful. But it's for about 30 seconds, 20 seconds, and then it wears off, and then it comes on again. It does this about half a dozen times, then there's an explosive stool, and then that's it. And this is well known. Oh, they call it something else now. What is it? I don't know. Doesn't matter. And it's probably, you know, the bowel's been irritated by bacteria infection and so on, and this is the remains of it. It's not a recurrence of the dysentery. The dysentery, that's all right. But I had that. I didn't have any recurrence of malaria. And I weighed. I didn't weigh very much, but I wasn't a skeleton. But I went off to the wars. I remember I weighed 11-11. That was very famous, as far as I was concerned. It was very easy to remember. And I think I came back, I was 9. So I was, you know, thinned down a bit.
And that was after a bit of feeding up, wasn't it?
Yes. Otherwise, health, I think, was all right, yes. At the end of, when I got my membership, the army, by the way, had not discharged me when I arrived back. They were marvelous. I went to, before some board, or I saw somebody, and he said, well, you better find your feet again. Go away for a while, and for a year, and let's see you at the end of that time. I thought that was marvelous. Wonderful. I mean, that solved all my problems for getting a membership. I tell you, I was lucky. And now I had my membership. I went back to the army, and I said, look, thank you very much. It's been wonderful. But I think I better be discharged now, because I'll be getting a job. As in fact, I had a job in mind for a registrar. And I went along, and they said, well, you better have a chest x-ray first before we discharge you. And I had a chest x-ray, and they asked me to go and see them. And I went, it was the chief, I forget what they're called now, chief medical officer for the RAMC. And he said, Duwarden, oh yes. And he had a drawer, and he took out the drawer, he took out the picture. He said, look, you've got TB. Thank God I was sitting. I had no symptoms. I felt fine. No troubles at all. And it was what's known as a minimal lesion, which is an entirely radiological diagnosis. I mean, it's nice to find it and get it at that stage. But and so he said, well, what did you want to do about it? I said, well, I'd like to go to Thomas's. I'd been there the whole year. Said, all right, off you go. Let us know when you're better. So off I went again. So I had another year getting over my TB. I spent 6 months. I spent about 3 months at Thomas's, and then 6 months in a sanatorium. And then I came out following summer, more or less. And this time I got out. And I was all right. So and I had the job to go to. But again, you see, it was easy getting a job because I had this paper on Wernicke's encephalopathy. Everybody thought that was wonderful. So not only had I been able to do my job, but I had had wonderful experience seeing things that I could write up, which were a great help. point of view of the career.
And was it only an experience like your POW one that gave that opportunity, do you think? You know, was it, could that research have been done easily elsewhere?
Well, no, because, I mean, the actual circumstances was what delivered the data. You could not repeat the circumstances and get it. I mean, it'd be criminal to do so, wouldn't it? So I was just lucky to be somewhere where these circumstances were about. It was a wonderful experiment, so to speak.
It would seem that your war experience had quite a big effect on your post-war career.
Enormous, enormous. I mean, I came back, and my name was made, more or less, you see. I was given a name, I was given a job at Thomas's without any trouble. In the neurology department, I didn't particularly want to do neurology, but I joined the neurology department. And that was fun. And then I got it, and as everybody knew I wanted to do research, I got a job in the Department of Medicine, the Academic Department of Medicine. And there I stayed for the rest of my life in one department, academic department or another.
You were saying earlier that, you know, you didn't know much about England apart from, your school days. But you were, of course, returning to a very different place, weren't you, post-war Britain, and a Labour government, and the ideas of the NHS.
Yes, you see, but politically, I was ignoramus, English politics, totally. And when you say my feelings about the NHS, I don't remember having any great feelings about it. To me, it seemed perfectly normal and reasonable and obvious to have a thing like the NHS. I had never wanted to do private medicine. Now I would do nothing else. I mean, I think the NHS is so militarized and so bureaucratized that if I do any medicine, I would do it outside of that. I would find something else, like Médecins Sans Frontières or something like that, I think, or Red Cross. I wouldn't. Oh, I think it's awful the way they have to do it. They have to never stop filling forms about how they're behaving, how they're doing, what they're doing. Terrible. But the Labour government originally, it is a brilliant idea, and it's a wonderful idea, and it's the right idea. Did you hear on the wireless the other day, the Americans are working out what they would do if they had some terrible catastrophe. And one of the English journalists said to them, well, who will pay for the treatment of these radiation suspects? And they didn't know. Because insurance won't pay, and there's no... I mean, no, it's perfectly obvious that something like the NHS is the only way to do it, for hell. And so I don't remember any... You see, I wasn't brought up in a family that was conservative, a family that was Labour. I wasn't brought up in the English political system at all. What politics I knew at home, my mother came from the South, in the United States. I was much more aware of that. And she was the one who threw a plate at me when I came home one day and sang Marching Through Georgia, not realizing what the implications were. This was Sherman marching through Georgia, the South, 40 miles of desolation, you know. Well, it's a nice tune. But she was very, very South. And that is about the sum of my political knowledge. As far as English politics, I had none at all.
How did you feel towards the Japanese after the war?
Contempt. Contempt. I still feel a bit of that. And also, how stupid. How stupid. They spoiled a wonderful labour force. Why do that? The Koreans were the ones I really hated. I mean, they were the ones who dealt with whom we had most of the problems. Though, of course, the Japanese were responsible for the overall situation we found ourselves and so on. But the Koreans were the ones that were ladling it out quite a lot.
Did you witness much brutality during the 3.5 years?
No, I did not. I never saw, apart from a good slap, I never saw anything else. I saw the people waiting to be shot outside the guard room. But I mean, that's not witnessing brutality. No. I mean, of course, one could say brutality from the point of view of sending the sick onto the railway, that's brutality. But you're meaning more violence, aren't you? Yes. No. No, I didn't witness violence. Plenty about, I think, particularly further up the river, the railway, I think.
How about the issue of compensation?
You
know, did you feel very strongly about that, you know, that the Japanese attitude towards...
No, I went along with it. I mean, I'm all for doing anything that'll make the Japanese suffer a little bit. And be aware of what happened, you know. They're such serfs. Even now they don't know. They are serfs. But I don't see why one set of POWs in the world should get money and others don't. And when you think of the horrors that went on in Europe and Russia, not that I was unhappy about getting £10,000 from the government. I'm not going to argue against it. I think that's fine. But, and of course, you have the way the European are treated. I mean, Australian prisoners of war, the Australian soldiers and American soldiers, all our allies, treat their POW, ex-POW is much better than we do. So I suppose that's the only way you could bring in a case. But I don't see an inherent justification, really. War is terrible, and we had part of it. Other people died. Other people lost their sight. Other people, you know. I mean, lucky to come out alive. To be paid for it is even better. But
you were saying how your own research, you know, really took off because of the war and the circumstances you were in. Do you think other medical innovation and advance came out of the war? You know, in your own situation, say the Far East, are there other things you...
I don't know about the Far East, of course. I mean, from point of view of trauma, I mean, if we're talking about the war in general, not about Far East war, the war in general advanced the business of trauma enormously. It's bound to. And transfusions and treatment of infections. Antibiotics were just coming in, you see. So, all that, yes.
Did you yourself have any experience of psychiatric problems? You know?
No, it's very interesting. People have asked me this before. What did we have psychiatric problems? And I don't remember any. And I have discussed it with others. And that's true. I think that's the general feeling. We didn't have hysterics or depressives or psychotics. We did. I remember when we first became POWs. You remember I got dysentery, and afterwards, the colonel asked me what I wanted to do. But before that, he had sent me off to fill in. Somebody, one of the psychiatrists, had developed dysentery himself, and I had to take his place while he recovered. So I was, for a fortnight, I was in charge of the psychiatric ward at Changi. And the psychiatric ward at Changi consisted of all the insane which had been gathered together before the ward started. So they really were psychotic. And I remember, I knew very little about psychiatry. The main thing I thought of doing was keeping my back to the wall. Never turning my... There were about 18 of them in a rather small, confined space. Some very adequate psychiatric nurses. And I thought, well, the only thing I know is medicine, so I better examine them all. And I found two of them who had something the matter with their chests, and that's why they were off their nut. So I felt rather pleased with myself, though the diagnoses were pretty awful. At least I had cleared up diagnoses, as one does as a doctor. But that's the... Otherwise, I don't remember. I didn't come across it. I saw an acute psychosis once in a colonel, but that was directly due I can't remember the name of the drug, but it was an anti-malarial drug, which we had a very small amount, and he was given it. And it was known, it was one of the complications, very, very unusual complication, but he got it. And that was terrible. He died within about 48 hours. Acute psychosis, I'd never seen it before. Acute mania. And this was at Tarkanoon. And he never stopped talking. Talk. And he was back at home, he was delusions and disorientated. And quite, not unhappy, but on. His temperature went up and up and up and up and up. And I thought, well, I don't know what to do about this. So I got some morphia. We had a little morphia. And I gave it straight into his vein. Zoom. And he was sitting up talking. And as the morphia hit him, he just went back on thing. One, two, three, four. Up again, talking. It was a remarkable phenomenon. The morphia just was destroyed straight away. You know, yes. But that had a good cause. I mean, that's the only one I remember. One didn't hear about them. Whether they were decimated earlier on and sort of sank out of sight with an attack of dysentery and depression or something, I don't know. But
did some people sort of cope with the situation better than others, do you think? Mm. And was that related to age or other factors?
Well, you have to divide it amongst the people who actually did the work and the others who were lucky enough not to have to do the manual work. And amongst the people who did the work, I can't talk too much because I didn't do the work myself. Difficult to say.
You dealt with them, though, didn't
you?
Oh,
yes, I did, but they were ill at the, time, you know. Mm. And... you know, there are some people who... You know, I find it difficult to talk about it because there's not much evidence. Looking back, or at the time. You know. And people were tired. They were tired. Exhausted. For one reason or another, or several.
Were you as well? Were you very tired?
I was when I was sick. I wasn't tired the rest of the time, no. No, when I wasn't sick, I think I felt quite well, really. But I was lucky, I wasn't working. I mean, it is a big difference. You have to get one of the people who actually worked on the railway to get the truth about that. And the fatigue must have been awful. Not just physical fatigue, but the mental strain, wondering how much longer. I mean, it was common to us all how much longer. We all felt that way. I mean, I can't say I had a bad war, really. Except that you never knew what was going to happen next. But of course you don't know what's going to happen next in any war, really. But it's rather nicer to think that what's going to happen next is in the hands of your friends and not of your enemies. That's the point. It's this feeling like a pawn. and they can do anything they like at any time they like.
Well, was there much sort of strain and stress when the war in Europe had ended? Did you hear about that?
Mm.
And the war was, you know, obviously going on in the Far East. And
I think there's a morale rose and rose.
Did it?
Oh, yes.
Did you know about these graves, these mass grave places being dug? Would you have known about that?
You don't mean Belsen?
No, the, you know, outside your camp.
Oh, no, we didn't know what those things were for until afterwards. We discovered that. Yes. I don't know who discovered that or when it was. I don't remember learning that at that time.
You didn't anticipate that something like that might happen?
No.